From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a diversion for those of you who voted today. One man, a remarkable man, trying to walk across Antarctica alone. The writer David Grand will join us to tell the story of Henry Worsley. Worsley was following in the footsteps of his hero, Ernest Shackleton. So join us for Radio West after this.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We were thinking of the kind of show to play on Election Day. We've done the analysis at this point, and of course, we'll be talking about what happened on Wednesday. So for today, we were thinking of doing something as a kind of diversion. And David Grand's story of Henry Worsley seemed perfect. Grand wrote The Lost City of Z. He wrote Killers of the Flower Moon, and both of those books were breakthrough hits. But earlier this year, he wrote a long piece for the New Yorker magazine about this modern-day explorer, a retired British military officer who had this obsession with the adventurer Ernest Shackleton. Shackleton, the man who led these expeditions to the Antarctic, these breathtaking survival stories. The man's name is Henry Worsley, and you'll meet him here in a moment. Worsley wanted to walk in Shackleton's footsteps, quite literally. And in November of 2015, he set out to trek across that frozen continent, 1,000 miles, and do it alone, unsupported. Grand turned the New Yorker article into a book called The White Darkness. He's going to be in Utah later this week. We'll tell you more about that later on the program. He joined us from a studio in New York City, and we began with this question. Why is it that so many explorers have been drawn to such a desolate and forbidding place?
You know, I think it's complicated, and I think even the people who did it sometimes struggled to express or put into words what motivated them to head out into what is, you know, arguably the most brutal environment in the world, where, you know, temperatures reach minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit, winds can blow at 100 miles per hour, one misstep and you suddenly plunge into a crevasse. I think for Henry, part of it was he revered Ernest Shackleton, the polar explorer, and he saw it as a way to test himself, a test of his own endurance. He saw it as a way to test his own leadership skills. And I think ultimately, even in Shackleton's day, where they were heading into areas where people had not previously been to, I still think these are, to a degree, inward quests, where they are trying to find out something about themselves, because there's nothing really externally there, and mostly what you're going through is suffering. Yeah. I mean, Shackleton spoke of piercing the veneer of outside things, and I think for Worsley, he really wanted to understand himself, and the only way to kind of do that, he saw, was in this isolation. And so for him, I guess to put it in its most simple terms, it really was a test of character.
When did you first find this story and decide you wanted to write about it?
Well, I have always had an interest in polar explorers, and I had read stories about people like Shackleton and Amundsen and Scott. I'm somebody who actually hates the cold, and I prefer to read these stories from the comfort of my living room, preferably by a nice warm fire. Right. And I had come across a reference back in 2015 in a newspaper that this British man named Henry Worsley planned to set out to do what his hero Ernest Shackleton had failed to do a century earlier, and that is to walk from one side of Antarctica to the other. And I was immediately drawn to the story.
Let's talk a little bit about Henry. You describe him, aside from being a retired British Army officer, you describe him as a sculptor and a photographer and a collector and a horticulturist and a boxer. he seems like his interests were all over the place. And I kept thinking, and this sort of came out later in something that his wife Joanna had said, was that he was a person seems like from another time almost.
Yes. And I think he was both instinctively that way and almost consciously that way. You know, he grew up reading adventure stories. He wasn't that into his studies when he was young, but he would disappear into the library and he would read adventure stories. And one day he read this story about Erna Shackleton from the heart of the Antarctic. And it kind of described people venturing out into these unknown spaces and these black and white kind of captivating pictures he would see of Shackleton and his men standing on these deskscapes. And those were his heroes. And he really consciously modeled himself after some of these kind of Edwardian and Victorian figures who had all these hobbies and dabbled in so many different fields. And Henry Worsley really was a polymath in many ways, just the way you described. I mean, he was artistic. He was a sculptor. He was a painter. He taught sewing to inmates in prison because he found that it calmed his nerves. And what made him so interesting was that he had this kind of duality to him, which is that he was as hard as nails in some ways. I mean, he was about as tough as they come. I mean, he was an army officer. He was a member of the SAS, an elite commando unit. He was someone who could be dropped into a jungle and figure out a way to survive on his own. And yet he also had this kind of artistic temperament, and he would recite poetry and keep a diary and teach sewing. And it's what made him, I think, a larger-than-life figure, and why, just as he really revered so many figures from the past, so many others around him who knew him both as soldiers and as friends really revered him because he was so distinctive.
Yeah. It's interesting. I kept seeing in the story you tell some of Henry Worsley's life being a kind of reaction to some of the things that he had seen. For example, his father. His father, which you say in the book, his father often seemed like a biblical force, and you describe the relationship. It seemed like one of those kind of, I have to say maybe these are caricatures, but the distant kind of British relationship with a man and his son, all stiff upper lip and business and no time for emotion or displays of affection. That on one hand. And then also Robert Falcon Scott, a leader that I'm sure he looked up to, but was also, as you say in the book, dogmatic and bullying and just ruled with this absolute authority. So those were kinds of models that he saw. And in some ways, it seems like he crafted his life in contrast to that, or his leadership, or the way he saw his own relationship with his own kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think he from what the family told me, really deeply admired his father. But his father rose, to the highest ranks of the British Army. I mean, he was not just a officer. He was, he rose to the very pinnacle. He was knighted by the Queen.
Yeah.
But he was not always present, partly because he was overseas, partly because of British culture. Henry went to a boarding school when he was very young. And so he was this removed figure. Mm-hmm. I'm always weary of psychoanalyzing, but inevitably we are all, byproducts of our family, and we all have these relationships. And one of the themes that I think runs through this story is the themes of fathers and sons and how we meet and how we try to seek our father's approval and to in some ways break apart at the same time. And then he certainly looked at Scott as somebody who represented a form of leadership. Again, Scott was the polar explorer who searched for the South Pole and hoped to become the first person to be there, and ultimately was beaten in a race to the pole by 33 days by the Norwegian explorer Amundsen. And then on the return journey, Scott had perished along with all his four men. And he wrote in his diary, before he die, we shall die like gentlemen.
Yeah.
And Scott had become this kind of revered figure for many years after his death in England. He was kind of seen as this martyr, this self-sacrifice. But in more recent times, there's been a lot of revisionist history looking at his character, his moodiness, his kind of autocratic qualities, temperamental qualities. There was a lot of infighting and bickering. He was very much of a kind of command structure leader. And I think Worsley, in trying to find a leader, you know, looked at polar explorers, and he did not want to be Scott. Yeah. And he ultimately settled on Shackleton as his model.
That's another theme that I detected in the piece, was this leadership model that Wolsey takes from Shackleton, whereas Scott led with this kind of absolute authority, and I'm guessing Wolsey saw that in, you know, when he was in the army as well. He led in a very different way. He led like Shackleton. He was sort of one of the men with them, and was determined that their outlook was, you know, optimistic. And I mean, that leadership thing seemed like a theme that that goes throughout the piece as well.
So Shackleton, you know, in many ways was a failure.
Yeah.
He tried to reach the South Pole on more than one attempt and failed, having to turn back because of the cold, because of depletion of food and the forces around him, the obstacles ahead. And then, of course, he had ultimately wanted to trek across Antarctica, which he saw as the kind of last remaining prize. And he so famously set out in his ship, the Endurance, with his men, and the boat became frozen in the ice before they even reached their base camp on the shore of Antarctica. And then gradually, after being – they were icebound and trapped in the boat, and then the boat sank, and they found themselves marooned on an ice floe more than 1,000 miles from the nearest island with any habitation, and they didn't have a radio. And so they had to figure out a way to get back. And Shackleton, miraculously, through powers of endurance and through kind of uncanny leadership, was able to get his party all back safely. None of them died in his group. And because of that, he has become a model for leadership. And so Wolsey was not alone, but he studied Shackleton when he became an officer and he went into the army, and he emulated his methods. And some of the things that set Shackleton apart was, you know, he ignored kind of the hierarchies of class and rank. And that was more unusual and radical in that time period of the early 20th century when he did that. He made sure everybody on the ship shared in the same chores, no matter their status. And though everybody, you know, knew who was in charge, and Shackleton's nickname was the boss, you know, he participated in the same menial chores and mingled easily with the others. He encouraged this playful atmosphere on the boat so that there would remain some optimism among this kind of just enormous dread.
Yeah.
He was always preaching optimism, patience, endurance. And those were qualities that Henry emulated in his own life, both as an officer and in every other realm that he went into.
It's interesting you write about Henry working when he was still in the army with the Afghan locals in 2006, and that one of the realizations that he had, or that he had written about, was that dealing with people was as much about empathy as it was about strength and firepower. So it seemed like those kind of human dynamics were something that resonated with him.
You know, it's a thing that kind of makes Henry so interesting, is that he was this person who was you know, I mean, he served tours with the SAS, this, you know, elite commando unit.
Yeah.
And he was as tough as they come. But he also was somebody who understood human dynamics, cared a great deal about culture and art. And I think one of the things that drew him to Shackleton, and that has drawn, kind of going back to your earlier question, drawn people into Antarctica, it is in many ways the perfect laboratory for human dynamics,
yeah,
for testing empathy, because you are suddenly thrown into a claustrophobic situation. You are suffering. You are hungry. And you all have to figure out a way to survive. And many expeditions have not fared well. You know, they begin to backstab and fight and bicker. There's been cases in history where there's been mutinies, and there's even been cases where one member of an expedition has killed another.
Yeah. It's you say there's a point when Wolsey stopped thinking about Shackleton's expeditions as being romantic and more about being tests of endurance and character. And again, these models for leadership. that was really interesting, that he's really looking almost, I don't know if he saw it as a direct template for the way he wanted to lead, but he saw
I think he did.
Yeah,
he
really?
Did. Hmm. Yeah, no, I think he did 100%. I mean, I think he saw the Shackletonian way as the way to model one's leadership. And, you know, those stories that he read when he was young, they were romances. They were kind of adventure romances. But over time, he really looked upon Shackleton as he would refer to him as a mentor, somebody who showed how to lead others into battle or lead others on expeditions.
You mentioned he finds, when he's at boarding school, The Heart of the Antarctic, the book by Shackleton. And the opening line of the book is pretty captivating. You quote it, "Men go out into the void spaces of the world for various reasons." And it mentions how, you know, some go for scientific knowledge and some are just drawn by this quote, "the lure of little voices."
Yeah.
Which was it for Worlsley? I think it was those little voices.
Oh, 100% of the little voices. Yeah. And he would the interesting thing about Henry is he heard those little voices ever since he was young. And he actually burned to become an explorer after he finished high school. But it's not so easy. How do you just become an explorer, a polar explorer? And I also think, getting back to the father-son relationship, he felt I don't think there was really overt pressure, but he went into the army like his father.
Yeah.
And when his dream was really to become a polar explorer. But he had always heard those little voices, and they had always kind of lingered in the background. But the question was, how do you become an explorer? And he had always feared, how could I actually pull off an expedition? And he was afraid, as so many are, of failure. And so but those little voices were his siren song, his temptation that he heard since he was young and he would continue to hear as an adult.
I wanted to talk more about Shackleton, because what's interesting, you mentioned this idea of failure, and that's another theme that I kept coming back to, and the way Worlsley is thinking about failure and the way he evolves in his thinking about the idea of what Shackleton's experience of not actually getting there taught him. And I wanted to ask you a little bit. So he makes this attempt with Scott, you say he returns from that attempt broken, Shackleton does. And 4 years later, he tries this expedition again, falls short. And this thing that he says to his wife, Ernest Shackleton, his wife Emily, "A live donkey is better than a dead lion." Talk a little bit about this and just how Shackleton is thinking of these ideas of going out there and failing and succeeding that Worlsley's thinking about.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's almost a whole kind of subgenre of literature about Shackleton, about kind of leading like Shackleton, the methods of Shackleton from Antarctica. And he's studied by astronauts. He's studied by military commanders, he studied by sports coaches, business executives, entrepreneurs, all of whom are interested in management and recruiting and kind of this mastery over your domain.
Yeah.
And normally they emphasize the Shackleton family motto, which is "by endurance we conquer." Right. And the central theme is that you can prevail. What's often overlooked is that Shackleton was in many ways a failure, and that he set out to reach the South Pole first with Scott. The expedition was bickering and Shackleton was suffering from scurvy. He got back to the ship and, as he said, he was broken. And then 4 years later, he set out on an expedition which was known as the Nimrod Expedition. Mm-hmm. He got within 97 nautical miles of the South Pole. I mean, it was almost there within his grasp. But fearing the depletion of food that it would take to get there and the welfare of his men, he turned back. And when he got back from that expedition, he said that quote, which you mentioned to his wife. He didn't discuss this failure, but he just said, "A live donkey is better than a dead lion." And clearly what he's saying is kind of reckless courage. Mm-hmm. Is worse than surviving, and that there is a success in failure, which is the triumph of survival, even if you're a donkey and you're not a lion.
Yeah.
And I think that gets to a deeper meaning of Shackleton, but one that is often overlooked and one that Henry Worsley would have to reckon with during his life as he tried to understand the deeper meaning of Shackleton.
He would invoke that line from time to time with Joanna, his wife.
Whenever he would go off on a dangerous expedition and on his first expedition, his wife Joanna, who's lovely, broke down in tears, and he held her and he said, he assured her, he said, "Don't worry." And he repeated that line that Shackleton had said, "Better a live donkey than a dead lion."
The story is also very much about David, it seems to me, his family. He meets Joanna in 1989. You talk about how in some ways they're complete opposites, but they absolutely have some kind of deep connection. You met Joanna, and in fact, you talk in the book in the acknowledgement section just how important that the family was to you telling this story.
Yeah, I mean, I think early on you had asked me, kind of what drew me to the story, and I talked a little bit about my interest in polar exploration, and I think my interest in these kind of models of leadership, I think, are really interesting. But one of the things that the story contains that really drew me to it is that it really contains a remarkable love story between Henry Worsley and Joanna. Mm. And they were, as you said, in so many ways opposites. She, she kind of hated the cold. She thought Antarctica was the most dreadful place in the world. And yet, as she told me, she said, talk about opposites attracting Christ. I'm a complete pavement girl. And yet they had this kind of deep love. And, she loved that kind of old-fashioned quality that he had, this kind of, sense of self-sacrifice and courage, these kind of old-fashioned ideals. And he really loved the way she punctured his stoicism. She was someone who was always encouraging him to go out and pursue his dreams. He felt that she helped him find his kind of hidden self in a way. And so they, they fell in love and they were married in 1993 and they eventually had two children. And, for Joanna, again, she always thought Antarctica was this just kind of awful place. Yeah. Think this cold, like who would want to go there? But she also understood that, to borrow a phrase, which I quote in the book from the writer from Thomas Pynchon, that everybody has an Antarctic, some place where they go to seek answers. The only thing was in the case of her husband, Henry, it turned out that that place was Antarctica itself.
Yeah. It's interesting how Henry's military career just it kind of foundered, as you mentioned. He's in his 40s and he's not really getting the same kinds of making the same kinds of advancements as some of his friends are and colleagues. And I take it he just kind of refused to play a kind of game.
Yeah, he was not. I mean, I think to rise to the highest levels of any institution, you have to play politics to some degree. And Henry really just didn't like to do that and didn't do that. And when he was set out as kind of one of the early scouts to Afghanistan before British forces were going to enter, he had warned that it was going to stir up a hornet's nest and cause a great deal of conflict. And at that time, that was not what wanted people publicly, the leaders, the politicians, or the people running the army wanted out there because they were trying to galvanize the public behind this. And that, I think, also hurt him. And so his career had stalled. And, given how high his father had risen, I think that was something he was aware of and that pained him.
At what point does he start collecting all of this Shackleton stuff?
Pretty early on. Yeah. And then, but his fascination only deepened and he would collect what he called the Shackletonia, which is, you know, any kind of memorabilia. You know, it could be like a napkin from an expedition, from Shackleton's expedition. It could be the diaries, the letters, the drawings, copies of photographs, anything he could find, he would collect. He had a room just that became overwhelmed. As Joanna said, Henry lost a fortune on Shackletonia.
I wanted to ask about when in early 2004, and he's, as you say, his career is kind of stalled and he's looking for something. And he meets Shackleton's granddaughter, Alexandra. And this sort of jump starts another phase of his life. She wants to introduce him to, is it Gao? Is it pronounced Gao?
Yeah, Gao.
Yeah.
Will Gao.
Will
yeah.
Gao. And Gao has this idea for an expedition. To tell that part of the story.
Yeah. So Henry had met Shackleton's granddaughter at one of these auctions where he was bidding on Shackletonia.
Yeah.
And, you know, she knew about his fascination, that he always had this interest in it someday, hopefully going to Antarctica himself. And she lets him know, you know, that, you know, well, he really needs to meet someone named Will Gao, who is another Shackleton descendant, who his great nephew. The other descendant who they choose is Henry Adams, who was the great grandson of Jameson Boyd Adams, who was the second in command on the Nimrod expedition. So you have those two, and you have Henry Worsley, who also had a special connection to Shackleton in that one of his ancestors, Frank Worsley, had been a member of a Shackleton expedition. And so they meet, and Gao has conceived this plan, which is in 2008, he wants to reenact Shackleton's Nimrod expedition.
Yeah.
On that expedition, Shackleton had tried to reach the South Pole and then had to turn back 97 nautical miles away. Mm-hmm. And Gao's idea is they will follow Shackleton's trail to the 97-mile mark and then from there press on to the South Pole, completing, in his words, unfinished family business.
Right.
And the other thing that makes the plan very novel is he wants it to be descendants of Shackleton or descendants of Shackleton's crews and Shackleton's expeditions. And so Henry leaps at this opportunity. I mean, he's always been lured by those little voices, but he's never quite found a way to do it. And how would you do it? And so he leaps at this opportunity to join this expedition. And then they're ultimately joined by Henry Adams, mm-hmm. Who's kind of a scrawny, not to belittle Henry, but Henry Adams, kind of a scrawny shipping lawyer. By the time of the expedition in 2008, which would be the centennial of the Nimrod expedition, you know, Henry Adams is 34 and Will Gao is 37. And Henry Worsley is about 47. So this is older in Henry's life that he does this. But the three of them, these three descendants, plan to try to see if they can walk to the South Pole in the footsteps of Ernest Shackleton.
It's amazing, I have to say. And I wanted to get a have you give people a sense of what it was like. Burning between 6,000 and 8,000 calories a day. And it just seemed – I have to say there were times when you wonder how people could do this. And we'll talk about Henry doing it alone or a similar thing alone later, but – and not just go crazy, literally, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it is a test of your sanity. I mean, the conditions – let's just – you know, the hardest thing for me – In telling the story, in many ways, was wrapping my mind around Antarctica because it's unlike any other place on Earth. It's more like writing about Mars or another planet.
Yeah.
It's a region that's 5.5 million square acres. It's larger than Europe, and in the wintertime, those coastal areas freeze over, so it doubles in size. It is the windiest continent with winds that can reach up to 200 miles an hour. It is, of course, the coldest continent with temperatures in the interior reaching, you know, minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It is the highest continent. And one of the things that struck me as the most peculiar element of Antarctica is it's covered in an ice sheet, about 98% of it, which contains about 70% of all the fresh water on Earth. And yet it's also classified as a desert because there's so little precipitation. So it's also the driest continent.
Yeah.
So it is a strange alien world. And as you head into the interior, there's no human life except for some little weird bacteria or something. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
There's no – you know, you're not – there's no birds. There's no seals. I mean, there's nothing. It's just a white, majestic landscape that is completely arresting and that at any moment might take your life. And in addition to those conditions, there are these crevasses, which are these kind of hidden chasms. And Henry would, you know, march ahead with his pole, and he would take his pole and he'd slam it into the ice in front of him. And if the ice gave way, he'd look down at this kind of endless dark chute. And some of these crevasses are large enough, you know, to swallow a car. So it is, you know, a beautiful and completely perilous landscape. And these three fledgling explorers, what's so interesting about them is they might have had exploration in their genes, but they had no exploration experience.
Yeah.
And they have to go through this kind of ruthless regimen of training, of dragging tires across fields in England. And then these three young professionals have to somehow adapt to this environment of desolation, of cold. What's more, they had to haul all their supplies on sleds. So it wasn't like there are food caches waiting for them. They have to bring everything with them. And those sleds weigh at the outset about 310 pounds, and that includes the weight of the sled. But that also always leaves you vulnerable to starvation because it's not like you can bring endless food because you can't haul it.
Yeah.
So they confront all of these obstacles at once.
There's a really – a kind of touching moment for me anyway when you tell the story when they arrive at the hut. This is the hut built by Shackleton and his party in 1908. You mentioned how Henry said he could hardly have gotten closer to Shackleton at that moment.
Yeah. So when they finally land there, they get flown from Chile to their starting point, which is on a place called Ross Island, which is part of the Ross Ice Shelf. It's the largest floating body of ice in the world. It's about the size of France. And they are going to start there before they head out. And as they're climbing up onto Ross Island looking for a place to camp, Henry Worsley suddenly comes to this abrupt halt because down below in the shallow icy basin, he sees this hut and he instantly knows what it is. It is Shackleton's, a hut that he had built in 1908. And where Shackleton and his men had stayed that winter before they had set out for the South Pole. And the three men, Worsley and Adams and Gow, they rush inside. You know, Henry Adams rushes over to the bunk bed, an area where his great-grandfather had slept. Meanwhile, Henry Worsley is eagerly examining every basically dark recess of the room. You know, there were still objects there. It looked as if, you know, Shackleton and his men had just momentarily stepped away and were going to come back. And at that moment, you know, Worsley says, you know, he felt as close to Shackleton as he'd ever been. And there was really nothing left to do now but to walk to the South Pole.
David Graham is a staff writer at The New Yorker. We're talking about his book, The White Darkness. Graham is going to be at Weber State University tomorrow talking about another of his books, Killers of the Flower Moon. That's at 11:30 on the campus of the university. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to. And you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diana Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer David Graham. We're talking about his book, The White Darkness. You mentioned what Worsley had said was the moment when Shackleton decides in his expedition to turn back. And Henry regards it as the most astonishing decision ever made in the history of polar exploration. And it's a big moment. It's the moment when as Shackleton writes, you know, man can only do his best, and we have arrayed against us the strongest force of nature. We have shot our bolt. Like that moment when he decided, I'm sorry, we've tried. We can't. We're finished. And that seemed like an important moment for Henry.
You know, Henry was somebody who had never really failed. I mean, yes, his military career had stalled to some degree, but he was still a very successful and revered officer. He was someone who had certainly never failed in any mission. His powers of endurance were extraordinary. He had always willed himself on. And he was someone who had shared in that notion that, you know, by endurance we conquer. Which was Shackleton's family motto, which he had painted on his sled. Yeah. He would also often repeat on the expedition and in life the unofficial motto of the SAS, which is always a little further, yeah. Always a little further. And he would just repeat those words. They were a mantra. And so this idea that Shackleton had reached the 97-mile mark, he was only 97 miles from the South Pole. And at that point, nobody had yet made it to the pole. So Shackleton would have been the first. He could claim his prize. And he knew he could reach it. Shackleton knew he could reach it. But to get there, he would deplete a lot of the food that would be necessary for the return journey. And he was worried about the welfare of his men who were already fading. And so he made this striking decision, which when the prize was within his reach and he could have claimed it, he decided to turn back. And he said he had shot his bolt and men could only do so much. And to Henry, you know, that was really one of the most astonishing decisions. Well, he called it the most astonishing decisions in the history of exploration, yeah. That he had made that decision when the prize was within his reach. And for Henry and his companions, you know, they walked and trekked to that 97-mile mark, and they went through so much. I mean, they had lost weight. They had been caught in whiteouts where they couldn't tell, you know, which way was up or down. Yeah. Henry Adams became so motion sick he had thrown up. And yet they had pushed to that point and they had gotten to that 97-mile mark exactly 100 years later than Shackleton. And so Henry, you know, he kept contemplating that terrible quandary that Shackleton had faced. And at one point he kind of turned to Gowan Adams and he said, I just can't imagine them after having come this far just turning around and walking back.
Of course, they made it, though, and they arrive on January 18th after, I think it was 60 days. What did Henry learn from that expedition? I mean, you say that he felt incredibly proud that one of the things he had done was adhere to the lessons of, I guess, the leadership lessons and the ideas of Shackleton.
Yeah. Henry Adams had referred to Henry Worsley as just an absolute bang-on leader. You know, for Worsley, managing this expedition was far trickier than when he had commanded soldiers in battle because his authority was not official. It had been kind of granted to him by Henry Adams and Will Gow. He had kind of assumed command of the party. He had no more experience as a polar explorer than his companions, and yet he had felt this enormous responsibility, the weight of their lives. And so he had managed to get them there. Often when they were pinned down in a tent by using Shackletonian techniques, by creating a playful atmosphere, by showing patience and preaching optimism, and also by persevering, by always kind of willing themselves forward. And Henry Adams referred to Worsley as just an absolute bang-on leader. And Worsley was struck by the fact that, you know, here they had been strangers not long before, the three of them, and yet they had become more than friends. They had learned to trust each other with their lives. And Worsley believed that they had prevailed by what he at that time really saw as the essential lesson of Shackleton, which was by endurance we conquer. Yeah. And what's so interesting, he had carried with him a compass that Shackleton's granddaughter had given him. And it was the compass that Shackleton had carried on his expedition. And she had hoped that this time it would reach the South Pole. And so when he got to that point in the South Pole, he took it out and he let the compass spin, the needle spin on the compass until it came to a stop. Could I interrupt for one sec?
Sure.
So I just wanted to mention one other thing too, which I think is just so striking in our conversation, which is that something about that 97-mile mark, because it gets to something you had asked me about earlier about, you know, kind of what are you finding and what drives you and what motivates you. So when Worsley and Adams Gao got to that 97-mile mark, their legs are wobbly, they're exhausted, and they get to this place that has, you know, filled their dreams and almost lured them to their demise. And they look around, and what can they see? Absolutely nothing. Just empty, barren, white ice all the way to the horizon. And so their grail, this place that had, you know, filled their dreams and almost killed them getting there, was really no more than a geographical data point. And Henry Adams said something which I think gets at what motivates people like this. He says, what is Antarctica other than a blank space on which you try to impose yourself?
Yeah. It was interesting. Adams said of Henry Wolseley that he knew that Henry Wolseley wasn't all that religious, but he felt a kind of spirituality of sorts.
Yes.
In the Antarctica.
And I think that gets to that mystical inner quest that Henry had, and there's no question he felt it. He was not a religious person, but he felt the spirituality about Antarctica. And he would, as we discussed a little earlier, you know, they would march for sometimes 14 miles a day, sometimes for 16 hours a day, 15 hours a day, just humping, dragging their sleds, reduced to little more than frozen mules as they pulled their weight behind them. They would then pitch their tents in these great windstorms and these whiteouts, crawl inside, and then Henry would say, all right, mates, I'm going to go out for a walk. And he would go out on these walks by himself, these strolls, because he just wanted to be alone for a bit. He just wanted to be in that landscape. And I think for Henry, that was part of that. He was looking for, I think, as we all do, some answers to the human condition. And that kind of solitude, being in that great landscape and being almost like a Buddhist monk in which you have driven yourself and there's this great self-abnegation, you're looking for some inner meaning. And I think Henry searched for that, and he found that to a great deal in Antarctica.
You say he didn't think he'd ever go back again after that, but he starts to feel that lure of little voices again, and launches this expedition that that you write about in 2012. Say something about that. It just seems astounding. And never people who hear about it, the idea of trying this trek across Antarctica alone, 1,000 miles, just seems unsupported, by the way.
Yes, yes. So Henry began to hear those little voices. And first in 2012, he does another expedition to the South Pole, this time following Amundsen's route.
Right.
And he becomes the first person to ever complete those two classic routes to the South Pole. And then in 2015, he hears those voices again, and he decides to set out on his most perilous quest, which was this trans-Antarctic crossing, which is what Shackleton had hoped to do before his ship, the Endurance, was frozen in the ice and sank. But whereas Shackleton had been part of a larger expedition, Worsley, who was then 55, planned to do this expedition alone and unsupported, which meant there would be no food caches planted along the way to forestall starvation. What's more, he could not have the assistance of dogs or kites. He would have to haul all the supplies, well over 320 pounds, as he trekked more than 1,100 miles from one side of Antarctica to the other. And nobody had ever even dared to attempt this feat before.
There's a moment you write about. There were a lot of these where that are just – they sound gripping and terrifying and terrible, whiteouts and all of the things that he has to go through. But there's this one part where you write about where he's getting up a section of the Antarctic Mountains, and it sounds truly amazing. It's this moment when he couldn't get the sled up, so he has to lighten the load of it and then make one trip after another up and back and then up and back and then I guess up and back. I don't know how many times, but it sounds impossible.
He did it all day. It took him all day. You know, this was Henry's hardest, his longest, his most punishing quest. And he also had to survive entirely on his own wits because he was alone. He was now the leader only of himself. And in some ways, being the leader of yourself is harder than being the leader of a larger party where your eyeballs are always on others. Now your eyeballs are only on yourself, and which is in some ways harder to see. You know, that is just a classic example of just one obstacle Henry faced, where he's climbing up and he reaches this part of the ice where there is this steep climb that rises hundreds of feet. And he gets there and he tries to start skiing up it with his sled, and the sled won't budge. It's like an anchor around his waist. And he looks around and it's freezing. And he knows if he stays there, he'll freeze. And so he's by himself. He starts to unload most of what's on his sled, most of his provisions to lighten it. And then he hauls himself all the way to the top of this mountain of ice. He reaches a ledge, and then he takes off the portion of his supplies and he puts them there. And he looks back down. He's out of breath. His mask is covering his face. And he has to go all the way back down. And then he has to go all the way back up. And then he has to go all the way back. And he did that all day. In his diary, he described it. And that's what he did all day. And that was just one of the many obstacles. But it just gives you some sense of the challenge. I mean, he's going through freezing temperatures, winds, he's by himself. And, you know, he can't leave those provisions behind because that is his sustenance. Mm. Everything on that sled is – he has reduced what's on that sled to every essential item that he will need to survive.
We get to the middle of January. He'd gone more than 800 miles. Virtually every part of him was in agony, you mentioned. He's worried about frostbite. He starts getting obsessed with the food that he was missing out on. Sort of, I can imagine his mind just thinking of, you know, mincemeat pies and ice cream and whatever it is that he's thinking about. But you write that whenever he faced a difficult situation, he's trying to decide, should I keep going? Can I keep going? What would Shax do? Talk about the decision he makes at this point.
So he ultimately faces this great quandary, same quandary that Shackleton had faced. And whenever Henry Worsley was in peril, and he was now in more peril than he'd ever been, he would ask himself, what would Shax do? And for him, the quandary comes down to Henry is somebody who has never failed before. He was never someone to give in. He was someone who believed by endurance we conquer. And he had managed on this expedition despite unbelievable obstacles, despite some of the most awful, brutal conditions he'd ever faced with one whiteout after another. He had managed to get, you know, to about 100 miles from his destination. And so history was almost within his grasp. He referred to it as a rendezvous with history. He was almost there. His prize was almost there. And yet he was on the verge of collapse, and it was unclear how much further until the cold consumed him. And so he faced the ultimate quandary where he had to try to figure out what would Shackleton do. And Joanna, he had a satellite phone, and Joanna had spoken to him by the phone and just said, you know, you've got to come off the ice. You've got to come off the ice. You've got to call for a rescue plane. Because he was so depleted. He had lost more than 40 pounds. He was, you know, getting frostbitten in the hands. His toenails were discolored. His every part of him throbbed and ached. His back ached. He had a mysterious pain in his stomach. And he says, well, I just need some time to think. And he, at that point, he could barely pull his sled, you know, more than a few feet. And he, for a day, he kind of just pitches his tent and he lays in his tent thinking, what am I going to do? What would Shackleton do? And ultimately, I think he came to terms with what was the deeper meaning of Shackleton, mm-hmm. which was he decided to call a rescue plane. And he says, echoing Shackleton, I too have shot my bolt. He realizes he had done his best, but that there is triumph in failure.
Yeah.
There is meaning in failure. And it is better to be a live donkey than a dead lion. And so he makes for him what is a deeply anguishing, painful decision, which is to say, I can't make it. I've come up against my human limitations, and that there are things in particular like Antarctica, that cannot be conquered.
January 23rd, the doctors find that Worsley was suffering from an infection of the inner wall of his abdomen. They rush him to surgery. He doesn't make it. And Joanna, who races to get there, doesn't make it to see his last moments. But seeing him in a wooden casket when she does arrive, she said he looked really peaceful.
Yeah, I think what was so anguishing is that Henry did make the decision to come off the ice. And as Joanna had told me, and as Joanna thought, she said, you know, he chose us. He chose to come back. And he had risen from the ice and walked on his own volition to the plane with just an enormous force of will, given his suffering. At that point, he did not know he had this internal infection in the thin tissue of his abdomen. And then they rushed him to a hospital in Chile where they discovered it. And then he went into septic shock. And he died of complete organ failure. And then Joanna saw him, you know, in that grave, and she kissed him. And they had, you know, a profound love that's hard. I don't think as a writer you can capture in words, but having spent time with Joanna and spending time with their kids, you can just feel it. Henry had always had his Antarctica to cross. And in many ways, Joanna's grief and the grief of their children has become its own Antarctica that they need to now endure.
David Gran, his book is called The White Darkness. Gran will be at Weber State University tomorrow talking about another one of his books, Killers of the Flower Moon. It's at 11:30. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.